Teach me your ways, O Lord, and I will walk in your truth.
Interface. Not the same questions, not the same answers.
Hi, this is Chris Holowaty, and welcome to Interface, an examination of Christian perspectives on thought, faith, and culture with Adam Mayers, the founder of the Stoa Foundation and the pastor of Disciples Church. Today we've got a full room. We've got Paul Sullivan, who is finishing up his doctoral work in the area of clinical psychology. His doctoral dissertation is on clinical and church support for marriage. We also have Eric Chandler, who is a seminary student over at Fuller Theological Seminary. So we got a full room here at Hanging Blanket Studios, and the topic for today is one that came up from an email that we received from one of our listeners. Although not directly a question that this person posed, but it was a topic that this person had brought up on divorce, and in particular, how the church is to deal with divorce. And obviously this is a very highly charged issue, and one of the reasons we want to have Paul in here is because he has done a lot of work in the area of divorce prevention and premarital counseling. So to open things up today, I'm going to throw this over to Adam to give us maybe a rough outline of some of the primary passages in Scripture that talk about divorce, and we'll start from there.
Well, Chris, probably the most classic is Jesus. Christ is quoted often in the Gospels, as one of his major tenets being about divorce, and it's framed a number of different ways, the quotes of Jesus. And it seems to be an issue about which the religious community of ancient Israel tried to trip him up. They constantly were working, just like we work now, over this issue of divorce. Think, for example, about the Pharisees who come to Christ. They say, okay, this woman had a husband and he died, and she took the levirate husband and then he died, and so she had seven husbands, and so whose wife is she? And always there's been a wrangling about the issue of divorce. Christ says very plainly, one marriage, that you're supposed to have a marriage, and that this marriage is supposed to endure for life. And he says, unless one divorces, except for the cause of adultery, and this is probably the most problematic passage, one commits adultery, and that one causes the spouse to commit adultery. And that's been the stickler for the church for ages, is the idea, does a durative sense of adultery go on after a second marriage? When is marriage and adultery the same thing? See, because what Christ does in doing that, he defines a certain marital state as adultery. There's the problem. To say that adultery is marriage and marriage is adultery, it's kind of like heads I win, tails you lose. And so Christ says in his discourse on lust, he says, if one desires someone else and divorces one's wife, is the way he put it, that does not justify, but he instead causes his wife to commit adultery. And that's been very, very problematic for the church. And Jesus adds a caveat. He says, excepting for the cause of adultery. So Christ really works on the adultery issue. And when they respond to him, well, but Moses gave us a writ of divorce, Christ's answer is, it was for the hardness of your hearts that divorce was given. And so the church has classically taken a stance against divorce as an expression, A, that it was not so from the beginning, from Edenic times, from Adam and Eve, B, that Christ prohibited it except in cases of adultery, and C, that it is an expression of hardness of heart and a legal issue on that. That's kind of where the difficulty comes up.
Now, in regards to church leadership, which is another area where the topic of divorce comes up, in that in 1 Timothy, one of the qualifications of an elder is that they be the husband of one wife. And in many conservative churches, that is interpreted to mean that a person who has been divorced is automatically disqualified to become an elder because they are no longer the husband of one wife. But I think before we get into the whole issue of how the church is to deal with divorce, perhaps we should first go back and define what is the big issue of divorce. Why is it that the Bible does come, it seems to express very strongly, one man, one woman, marriage, that's sacred, it's supposed to stay that way. And like you said, Christ seems to set down a very firm foundation that divorce is not acceptable with God. What is it about divorce that, and perhaps I can frame the question this way, what is it about divorce that seems to upset God so much?
Well, I think it depends on whether you're asking Paul or not. Not Paul Sullivan here, but the Apostle Paul. Paul would probably say because it's a mystery that's meant to express the nature of Christ in the church. But I think we also have to look at a purely sociological level, that divorce or marriage, man-woman relations, yes, that's how we define marriage here at Interface, represent the deepest and most ancient founding stones of taboo, of identity, of clan, of society generally. That the basic unit typically for human society is a couple, a man and a woman creating a nuclear family. And it is from that that clan becomes developed, tribe becomes developed. And we see, obviously, in ancient Israel that there is a lot of stock placed on ethnic lines, tribal lines, descent lines, family groups. Jews are Jews because they come from Abraham. And so this heart institution, socially, of the most foundational relationship is the couple. We could say, on a purely pragmatic level, God intended for human beings to have, if you want to say, safe and stable society. In other words, safe and stable relationship with each other, that it is not good for someone to be alone, and that there is to be a deep level of intimacy between these two, and ultimate trust, ultimate loyalty, ultimate love. And we see in the pattern of Christ that that love involves self-sacrifice, that this is ultimate love, ultimate commitment, ultimate loyalty. And I think that because the marriage is to reflect those deep forms of loyalty and those deep forms of trust, that it is among the class of sins that come as betrayals, lyings, injustices, injuries, where harm is done. And that's why the marriage resides in there. So it has, so to speak, marriage has its fingers in all the pots of basic justice, basic trust, basic love, social foundation, loyalty to children, loyalty to parents, loyalty to clan. All of these things reside in this institution of marriage. So it bears the sociological, the psychological, and the spiritual marks of a valuable institution for ancient Israel, and really everywhere in the world. Everywhere in the world, you find coupling as a foundational right.
I think as we talk about marriage within a society and the importance of that being within the relationship, and it really seems what we're talking about here is a covenant between the couple as well as a covenant to society in general, a spiritual covenant with God. The covenant relationship, in a sense, forms a foundation of beginning to look at the problems that come up. Looking at marriage and divorce from the standpoint of a covenant really allows us a unique insight into the whole situation of marriage and divorce. Perhaps an appropriate question at this time would be to look at the scriptural foundation of covenant relationship.
You're right about that, Paul. Covenant is a huge issue, and that's where I'm saying it goes back to the very foundational issues. Let your yes be yes, your no be no. It represents obedience to God in covenant. Covenant meaning promise or contract or testament, any of those things. Basic agreements between human beings. The most powerful things that we can do are vows. If you raise your hand and vow in a court, you are liable for that. If you sign a signature, you are liable for that. And these forms of embodiment of the will are found really, really deeply in Scripture. Don't lie. Don't make false contracts. Don't give false witness against your neighbor. Don't violate. Don't covet your neighbor's wife. Don't covet those things. If one thinks about it, the idea of a property right is a completely abstracted idea. That is my camel. That is my house. This idea of like a genitive relationship to your stuff is a legal, justice relationship, and yet it reflects back on basic ways. Do we act in love? Do we not act in love? Do we act in truth? Do we not act in truth? And so do we act in covenant and actually put our volition as a tangibility and let it be binding upon us, or do we not? And that's where it becomes a big issue to God, because when you invoke a vow, you say, I am bringing God into this as the guarantor of this vow. Then if I treat that vow lightly, I have taken his name in vain. In other words, assuming that though I have invoked him to guarantee the vow, I really don't think that he has the power to do it. And that's like that idiom in ancient Israel, does Yahweh see? So that's why these things go to the heart of the divorce issue. What is true intention? What does it mean to symbolize one's true intention and loyalty and obligations to another? And what role does Yahweh, or, you know, the Lord, play in the guaranteeing of these contractual statements? So when you swear, yes, I will give you 2 camels for 50 shekels, and then you swear, as Yahweh lives, I will do that, and then you rip the guy off for 40 shekels or whatever it might be, that's taking the name of the Lord in vain, and he says, I will get you for that. Don't treat me like an absent partner in this whole thing. And I think that's one of the things we have to consider about the divorce issue and the idea of covenants and contracts. I think you brought this up in our pre-show discussion here, that covenants may be broken many ways. There are many aspects to a covenant, and then we have to say, at which point is a covenant so perforated that it is no longer any kind of a commitment? And we see that in legal contracts too.
Adam, that last statement that you made brings up just a thought to my mind. When you talk about covenant, and obviously that's the theme throughout the Old Testament, you know, when God's dealing with Moses and Abraham and just the whole patriarchal society, it seems that it was a covenant between, obviously it takes two people. So this is an issue of what happens when one party breaks that covenant. What happens when one changes their mind about their intent? And it seems to me, as I think back over Scripture and just how that transitions from Old Testament into New Testament, is it seems to me that when the Gospels, when they portray Jesus as talking about divorce, that he almost doesn't want to give an answer, but that they're pressing him to give an answer. And somewhat, it kind of reminds me of what we're doing here today. We're taking some text, and we're taking from Old Testament and covenant and New Testament, and we're trying to mix all those together to find out, does that have the same aspects and concepts of what we see as covenant today? So it went from kind of a covenant issue to a faithfulness issue. And we move from a contractual kind of tapestry to a spiritual kind of tapestry.
In that, you begin to hit on the heart of the problem there in the Matthew passage with Jesus' discourse. He's obviously speaking in it a discourse against legalism and against the process of, if I satisfy the protocols of going through a writ of divorcement, somehow I am now entitled to sleep with my secretary. You know, somehow say, I see my secretary, we have an emotional thing going on here, but I'm married. And then I go through the process of dumping my wife and getting my secretary as my new wife, you know, the new improved version or whatever it might be. Then somehow God is satisfied. And Jesus' point is, no, you abrogated the covenant when you decided to break the vow, not when you've finalized the papers. So then to say, unless the vow has been broken beforehand, don't you be the one to break the vow. That's Jesus' basic point. And ironically, we turn that text now into a new legalism. When Jesus is trying to speak, this is not about legal protocol, it is about intentionality. And then we turn around and we turn it into a Christian evangelical legal protocol, and we say, do you meet these criteria? You know, so for example, there are many marriages where someone has quite frankly pushed the other one into an affair. Who is the one who really committed adultery in that one? You see, the difficulty is that Jesus' point would be, in pushing another one toward that, then the intention to push the other one so far that they will violate the contract means that you actually violated the contract, not they. But we do a lot of that jockeying in the church to see who will save face when the whole thing burns down and who gets to stay in leadership and who doesn't. You see, very difficult situations.
Talking about this whole idea of pressing for an answer, I think of Corinthians and just the whole idea of, I mean, these people took things to the extreme. You know, they'd take something good and they'd just blow it out of proportion and go just like 100 miles an hour the opposite direction with a good intent, I think. But it presses Paul to give some protocol about how to act in certain situations.
I think, Adam, when you begin to talk about a covenant relationship there, you're bringing up a good point, especially when we begin to talk about this discourse that Jesus had with the Pharisees. The idea that he did not want to answer that and his reply to them seems evident that this is something I believe both grieved Jesus' heart and God's heart as well. And when I believe that the Pharisees were referring back to the issue with Moses and when Moses would grant a writ of divorce. And I believe the whole idea of covenant here is that this is to be a lifelong thing. And when they were talking about this, it seems clear on Christ's heart that it was never God's intention that a divorce would be granted. It was only because of the hardness of the people's hearts that it ever was allowed through the law. And even in those situations, it seemed clear that this covenant relationship was a piece of it. The fact that only when that covenant relationship was broken, even, was there ever a divorce allowed. So I begin, as I work with couples in counseling, the issue that comes up when I come in and the couples are really grieving over whether or not, you know, I can get a divorce, or, you know, wife will come in and my husband's asking me for a divorce, and what do I do? Is this okay, and how do I deal with this? One of the issues that we begin to work through with the couple, or with the individual, in whichever the case may be, is the issue of covenant relationship. And when has that covenant relationship been broken? I believe you mentioned that there are numerous ways that a covenant relationship can be broken. And when is that covenant relationship broken to the extent that it can no longer be repaired? And I believe there always needs to be an attempt at that repair. And yet there are also certain circumstances, too, when for the safety and the integrity of the individual, say cases of extreme abuse and physical abuse and extreme emotional abuse, there's always situations like that where there's extenuating circumstances, extreme examples of the rule that obviously need to be looked at separately. But really what I believe it gets down to is an examination of this covenant relationship and when has it been broken to the point where, though it is not God's intention, a divorce is allowed through the law. And then we get back to this whole issue of legalism along those lines, and it really becomes a tough issue that goes round and round in circles in the church, and it's a really tough issue. I'm glad we're dealing with it here today.
I find it interesting that it's somewhat ironic in that Christ was trying to speak against legalism, and I don't think his intention obviously was to set up a new rule of when you can have a divorce and when you can't. In today's culture, and particularly in the church, obviously the rate of divorce has gone up considerably, and yet I would argue that we don't really appreciate just how much divorce happens, because we are still trying to quantify divorce as when are the papers signed, when does it actually occur, as opposed to really looking at, I think this is what Christ was driving at, was what is the heart behind a marriage and what is the heart behind a relationship? When you begin to emotionally pull yourself away from your spouse.
Even sexually. Paul says your body is not your own. And he's very, very clear about that, that there's not to be a break in sexual relations. So one partner violates Paul's mandate, and the other one has an affair.
And who winds up being guilty.
And who winds up being guilty, as who violated the marriage and its vows.
So I think in dealing with this topic along those lines, we also need to really examine, I think, our own marriages, for those of us who are married, to really watch out for those things. It's easy for the church to be judgmental on those who have ended a marriage. We want to try to pin blame. You want to try to focus on who is at fault. And then we start bringing up these other passages, like from the pastoral epistles, about, well, now you're disqualified for this or disqualified for that. And if we're going to be consistent with the message of Christ, he was obviously very pointed about saying, look, sin obviously does not occur just in the actions, but it occurs in the heart. if you look upon someone else's wife with lust, you have committed adultery. And I think we have to be careful as a church that we don't lose the heart of Christ in how we respond to divorce and how we deal with the problem of marital faithfulness. And this is one thing I'm glad that Paul's here to talk about this, but one of the things that we have to be careful with in counseling is to make sure as pastors and as leaders in the church that we are not simply trying to quantify the members of our church and trying to put them in categories to determine what they should be doing and what role they should play in the church. We need to be very careful with that, because I think the church, particularly the conservative church, and this is my perspective on this, is that the conservative church really likes to quantify behavior and really likes to set up guidelines and very strict rules about how we are to conduct ourselves in the church and who can do what, whether we talk about women's roles or whether we talk about marriage and divorce and all that kind of a thing. I think we need to be careful that we don't lose a perspective of grace and don't lose a perspective of what Christ was trying to say in that, was that it's not just about doing things the legal, proper way. And not to put words into Christ's mouth, but I don't think Christ was trying to say, hey, this is the way you're supposed to go about a divorce. Okay, if your husband or wife cheats on you, then you can get out of it. If they don't, then you're stuck in it, or whatever. You know, it's like some kind of rigid line of demarcation. I think the focus of Christ's message was more of, be very careful with your heart. Be aware that it is very easy to commit adultery, and it's very easy to commit things that would qualify you or would break the covenant between you and your spouse. And so don't be so quick to judge someone else who has gone through a divorce.
Ironically, if someone is in that situation that you mentioned, Chris, of just waiting for the other person to commit adultery so that they can get out of their marriage, what Christ would say is, you already got out of your marriage, which means that you're the one who violated it, if you're only waiting for the other person to slip up. Or if you don't have a heart of forgiveness toward that person when they do slip up, then you have already denied them your love. You've already denied the intentionality of full commitment behind them. And so, you're the one. And like you say, it's very easy to commit adultery if we are going to hang on the words of Christ and say, these are the absolute rules, now we can utilize these statements to build our framework of legality and protocol. Then we will have to take, at the same value, Christ's statement, whoever looks on someone has committed adultery. Because if we're going to take the statement, if you divorce and they go, then they're committing adultery, then we must also take the statement, whoever looks has committed adultery, and whoever has hated has committed murder. And quite frankly, I think that would decimate the ranks of the church for leaders, that anyone who has lusted or anyone who has hated is either a murderer or an adulterer or adulteress. And in doing so, then we have to say, well, how rigidly are we going to hold these qualities? Because Paul says not, you know, literally a one-woman man. And yet Jesus says, well, if you lust after somebody, you're an adulterer. So then I would speak for most males, none of us should be leaders in the church, you see, because we fail the criteria. And additionally, then we have to ask the question, well, does Christ or does Christ not forgive adultery? How did he deal with adulterers and adulteresses when they were presented with legal situations? And if we are to be Christ's body and the expression of who he is, how then are we to treat adulterers and adulteresses? Because Christ would say, I came to forgive that. Do we or do we not, as evangelicals say, we are here to represent the forgiveness of Christ and to say, when you repent, you are forgiven. Or are we here to say, no, there's a durative thing that Jesus' death really didn't quite take care of, and we're here to make sure that that follows you everywhere you go the rest of your life? So are we busy trying to proclaim the work of Christ or oppose his work of erasing sin? And I think that's really the critical question we have to ask ourselves. Are we being true to Christ?
Well, that's about all the time we have right now, and obviously we've only scratch the surface, which is what Brad always says at the end of every show, because that seems to be all we ever do. We are going to continue this discussion on a later show. Some other questions that have been brought up are, how should the church deal with people who have experienced and gone through divorce? What is the role of the church to be for them? Can they be in leadership? We'll find out. We'll talk about that next time. This has been Interface. Thank you so much for listening. I'd like to thank Adam, Paul, and Eric for being here. I'd like to thank Hanging Blanket Studios for their facility. I'd like to thank myself for engineering this show. I'd like to thank my wife for providing the sustenance and the water. And really would like to thank you for listening.